Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. So, Carl, you are the managing director for Turner Studio. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Turner and where you work and what you focus on?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Turner started as a practice back in 2001, and we're actually part of a previous partnership that dissolved at that time, and there was about 15 of us. And so half went with one principal, half went with the other. And that's how we kicked things off. And I don't know, I guess I made the right decision. And we had a very strong little group. And for the next, 15 years, we grew at 20% year on year.
Wow.
Rapidly. It was crazy. And we rapidly outgrew our offices. So every 5 years, we've sort of moved office. You do get to a certain size where that starts to stabilize. And, we've probably hit that point now. But it's been over 25 years, which is not what I expected when I started out my career, that I would be at one place for this long. But when a company keeps evolving and changing so rapidly, you're never standing still. And so the challenges just keep coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you, so it was, I'm looking on your LinkedIn as I'm looking up here, Sastic Turner, which started in 1998. So it was only going for a few years and then sort of Turner kind of went off from there. And that's fascinating.
It was going for a bit longer. So I joined it in 1998 because prior to that, I'd graduated in 1995, 96, and then went straight over to Malaysia. And was practicing over there in KL until the Asian economic crisis blew everything up. And I came back to Sydney beginning of 1998. And then after running out of money, I had to go find a job. And a friend was working at Stanisich Turner. So my first interview and my first job. And I don't think I've had to do an interview since, which is quite unusual.
It's quite interesting when you get people and you're like, and I haven't done it for many years. And you're like, it is a job in finding a job and how to go about it. But essentially be your authentic self and it will come out as well. So, look, I think there's two really interesting things that I'm interested to have your take on there. Obviously, having worked in Malaysia and the Asian market, obviously then Turner working in Australia and in the UK, so primarily in Australia and New South Wales. I'm really interested in what your perspective is on the international. My second thing I'm interested in to unpack with you too is what you've seen at different growth stages as well, and just in sizes of firm, and then what you felt like some of those points have been. You know, we often talk about that, a firm gets to this size and this size and this size, but also what that looks like, obviously, on that trajectory of that kind of really steep and then that stabilizing, whether it's been staying the same size or just growing at more of a steady, slower, smaller growth rate as well. So where would you like to start? Would you like to start on the size?
I think the international context is quite interesting. Because I've lived in New York for a couple of years. I've lived in Malaysia for a few years. And I must say that the New South Wales and Sydney real estate market is very, very sophisticated. It's a very sophisticated product, the way that we stage places for sale, the professionalism of our websites that we use. I'd even say the professionalism of the real estate agents, which everyone might laugh at, but go and do it overseas and it's completely different. So that's definitely one aspect of it, that I find Sydney quite sophisticated in that sense. Every market has its nuances. And I'd say that we're very similar to some of the Asian cities in terms of the kind of living arrangements that we're sort of moving towards, densification and much more urban cities. They've been doing that for a very long time. And so there's good and bad learnings. There's places like Singapore, which I think have done it quite well in terms of a densifying city, but still looking at, public infrastructure and landscape and, a livable city. And then other places where the governance hasn't been there and, it's overridden by expressways and there's no footpaths and trees get chopped down. And you can see where they've had this amazing opportunity. And unfortunately, over the last 20 years, they've missed it. And whether or not it's now too late. And so in some ways, Australia is actually behind those things because we haven't had that same population in such a small space that has forced us to do things so rapidly, but we are now on that cusp. And so there's definitely lessons there about the way to do things and end up with a very livable city. So I enjoy working in Sydney because of that, because it's a very sophisticated market. In terms of the growth side of things, I mean, it's all to do with the densification of the city. So when we started the practice, we weren't doing houses. We were doing urban renewal down in Zetland. It was, you know, the residential flat design code had just come out in, I think, 2001 or 2002. And there was a move towards apartment living in Sydney, which had only really started probably in the mid-90s. And so our practice was built on that. We won a few competitions. We spent a lot of time working down in Victoria Park. And that enabled our growth. So from 7 people, you know, it rapidly just went straight to 15. And then 15, it went to 30. And at each of those stages, as you say, there are these kind of natural points where things settle for a while, and then you have to push through that and go through those growing pains to get to that next sort of, you know, I guess, milestone of size, where each time you do that, it enables you to do something more. So whether that is to bring in a business development person or to have a person reception answering the calls, because, you know, in the first few years, everyone picks up the phone, everyone puts the garbage out and empties the dishwasher. So you get to a certain point and you can start to get to a scale where you can add bits on to your practice that starts to free up your time to do the architecture. And then, of course, you reach this certain stage where the administration becomes much larger, and then you've got a COO and a finance person and a HR person and all these other things that is about the business of architecture. And we're at that phase now where, you know, we have all these standalone departments which are required to get the whole practice running. And with that comes the economy of scale. So you can afford to take on more projects. You can say yes to more things and possibly not be so scared to say yes to lots of things because you know that you can absorb them. And also the history of having done it before, you know, yes, we'll be able to fit it in and we'll be able to get it going. And yeah, sort of.
We can do that.
The growth. Yeah.
And so just to confirm your sectors that you're working across now, so it's still mainly living-led, or is it other sectors that you've diversified into?
In New South Wales at the moment, it's the living sectors. So when we first started, it was much broader. We were doing resorts and car showrooms, office buildings, all sorts of things, warehouses even. And then as you know, this move towards a denser city has happened, and especially in New South Wales, the focus has then shifted more towards the living sector, but it's still fairly broad. So it's anywhere that a person puts their head down on a pillow at night. So from the shortest stay of a hotel through student accommodation, co-living, all types of housing, so social, affordable, market, build to rent, and seniors living. So it covers the full spectrum of living.
And I was just going to say.
Well, I was saying, and then we like to mix that with lots of other uses. So that's when there will be retail and a bit of workplace, an automotive workshop. That's what then starts to make them really interesting when you get these hybrid models.
Which is, I suppose, the future, really, or where a lot of developments are going now. As well, and particularly for a developer, it is something that makes it stack up a lot better when you've got two potential pathways or in two different sort of things that you can be offering, right? And it also depends on who the person is or who the developer is or where the money's coming from and what they're funding in that way as well.
Yeah, definitely, because the sectors, they change in terms of what's viable and what's not and, you know, where there's demand. And so, yeah, some parts support others, but it's also the way that we live now that people actually desire to be living in mixed-use precincts where things aren't so separated, so you don't go home to a suburb at night, you know, to live and then work in the city and recreate somewhere else. Now we really want all of that at once. And so planning was not set up that way. So, you know, the old zoning where R is residential and, you know, MU is mixed use, they have a tendency to still want to segregate things, you know, in a very traditional way of looking at the city. And, you know, we've seen the shift as well to the idea of much more mixed use zones where you create a whole sort of series of different uses that support each other.
Yeah. And it's interesting how that will continue to develop. But I'm sure, like in the UK, and as you've talked about in Asia, and I'm not so sure about the US. You know, we sort of see the US, but on a personal level, I haven't been there to see what that is. But obviously looking at people's folios and even what you see around, I think it's not necessarily as sophisticated as the Asian markets or Australian market is. Is that an incorrect perception?
I think it depends on where you are. So I was fortunate enough to be living in New York. And again, that's its own little bubble within the States. And it's always the density. The density drives this. And so what you can do in Asia is even different to what you can do in Sydney. Just the number of people living so close together. You can have a small destination, little restaurant, you know, three floors up or around an alley. But because people know about it, it survives and thrives. You try to do something at level two here, you know, in Sydney, and it dies because we just don't have the density that drives people to seek these things out. And New York was like that. New York had an amazing bar and restaurant scene. And that's because the apartments are so small, people don't entertain at home. They all go out. And so, we were one of those people that moved our furniture over from Sydney and had a dining room table, and people wondered what it was and why we had it. Like, why would we waste having a dining room table in our apartment when, you know, everyone eats on the couch with their order in, or they go out?
You know? Incredible.
It drives a very vibrant nightlife, and it's the same in Asia. It's got an amazing, vibrant after work. You know, it's very long. It'll go to 2 o'clock in the morning. It's not unusual for people to go and get a meal at 2 o'clock in the morning. Try that in Sydney after 9:30 and the kitchens are closed. So, you know, it's all about density.
Well, I moved from Melbourne to Queensland, and I can tell you that's a very big difference in those types of things. But it's interesting because obviously, you know, I lived in Melbourne all pre-COVID and during COVID. And actually one of the reasons I sort of moved was because I felt like the city had lost. I had kids, so, you know, that ability to go and do those things changed as well. But it is that funny thing where you talk about that, because that very much was a Melbourne culture, and I knew they had built that up in the 2000s, really late 90s, 2000s. There's been a lot of energy trying to get people into the city and really invigorating the city. And I obviously had friends who lived in the city, and there's a lot of people who do. And that's what you do. You go out and you're not necessarily at home. You're actually living in the city. So it's very interesting versus coming to Queensland, that density is being built because it's also not going to drive the infrastructure unless we do, you know, rezone into higher density. But it's interesting getting that cultural shift into it. I would say, though, I feel like, because I work nationally and I'm in every city quite regularly, I feel like Sydney actually has an incredible vibe going on in it at the moment. And I feel like the things that have been done over the last few years have really ignited the city. So I'm interested in that, you know, where you're saying things aren't working. I feel like at least on ground level, particularly in the CBD, there seems to be an enormous amount of activation going on.
I would say it happens in pockets. So what's been happening in the city has been good in terms of the pedestrianization of large parts of it. And there are more interesting sort of venues that are opening up in the city. I think where the vibe has shifted is to Enmore Road and King Street in Newtown. That's incredible compared to our office is on Oxford Street in Darlinghurst. This used to be a great street. Full of like restaurants and again bars and nightclubs and interesting shops. It's gone through a real decline over the last couple of decades. We've got rows of empty shops now. Our supermarket just closed down a couple of weeks ago. So it's getting some reinvigoration towards Taylor Square, where there's been a new development called Oxford and Foley, which is just completing after many, many years. And I mean, King's Cross has gone through, I guess, a renaissance where I guess the bars and clubs turned over into restaurants and more high-end kind of wine bars and things like that. So things go through their transitions, but I wouldn't say Sydney is vibrant at the moment in the, I'm in Surry Hills and Darlinghurst. Surry Hills is definitely better. And certain streets now are becoming well known, like Albion Street has a lot of bars and restaurants on it. But I spend a lot of time down in Melbourne, so I'm probably down there every second weekend. I live in between the two. And I would say Melbourne is getting its mojo back, definitely.
You feel that?
Yeah, and I think it's partly to do with the students coming back. So having students living in the middle of the city again drives people, cheap eats, people going out. It's way busier in Melbourne CBD at any evening compared to Sydney, because we don't have a lot of people who live in the city here in Sydney. It still kind of empties out,
That
past
is,
6:30,
yeah,
7
you're
o'clock.
probably, yeah, okay, yeah, and it's interesting in those observations. So, and where do you see that? I suppose obviously the Melbourne market at the moment is, it's not as confident as other markets. Where are you sort of seeing, I suppose, just on the Australian context, of where New South Wales versus Victoria is at present?
Yeah, it's a very hard one to figure out that Melbourne had a lot of apartments being built, and so there does feel like there's an oversupply in the city. But when you get outside of the city, it's a tighter market, and there's more like equity and growth in residential. But the city is definitely suffering, and I think it's quite slow down there. You do hear anecdotally that there's people leaving, Sydney to go and work and live in Brisbane and Victoria. So you would think that that should be driving a bit more demand, but potentially they're not wanting to live in the CBD. It was more student focused in the past. I don't know whether it also had a slightly bad reputation in the past as well. But now they have their own apartment design guide standards down there in Victoria. That will raise the quality and hopefully make people feel more confident to live in the city. It's where I live down there. We live right in the middle of the city there, and I love the location and being there. But I do understand that if people want more space and more amenity, they'll move out of the CBD. Whereas in Sydney, it's still where every tourist probably lands. It's where people who are coming to Australia to work, it's probably the first place they look for a job. So the underlying demand to live in Sydney is driving, I guess,
Well,
property
and
development.
I mean, Sydney is actually one of the most magnificent cities. And as you said, it is, I think it's one of, and Melbourne and Sydney are both international cities, if we would put it that way. And as you said, most people, if they're immigrating from to Australia, will land generally in one of those two cities. And then go from there. And you can feel the difference. Somebody who's moved to Queensland, just the cultural diversity within the city. And I suppose even that from an overall point of view, you just don't even see that. Like, the restaurants, I'm used to living right in the heart of, right on the fringe in Richmond, Abbotsford, Collingwood, right when it was going through that gentrification. And there's enormous amounts of things going on and doing that, but there's so much diversity within different, foods that you can get, even different cultures around. Whereas in Brisbane, I would say it's not quite much, or it's a lot harder to be able to access that. So I can understand people are landing. And I mean, Sydney as well, I feel, is a city that it's obviously, it still is the financial hub for Australia. There is so much going on there. It's absolutely stunning. Every time I fly into Sydney, I'm always like, I just absolutely love coming to Sydney. But at the same time, though, it can take people an hour and a half to get to the CBD. And I suppose that's where the sprawl, and obviously where it's quite hard as well, just with the bay, whereas Victoria's more of that. Is coming around a circular bay, and there's a lot more of a radius, but people are now sort of commuting, and I suppose that density is building up further and further from the first few rings now out to the outer rings as well. So it's interesting. Obviously, Victoria also has had a lot more working from home, and that's being also driven as well. So are you seeing that's having an impact on sort of what people are looking for, and those, I suppose, those communities that are being created outside of the CBD as well?
Yeah, I don't think, our lockdown wasn't as harsh as Victoria. So there's definitely more people, I believe, at work and have returned to work rather than working from home here. And so there is still definitely a lot of work from home. I don't think that will ever change. What has been a real game changer here is the rollout of the metro stations, which has improved connectivity amazingly. And so places that I would normally drive to for meetings, I'll always choose to hop on the metro now.
Yeah.
It's so quick. And so what that's done is open up these areas for people to live, which is more affordable. But still, you can live quite far out of Sydney now and then be in the city in 40 minutes on the metro.
Yeah.
And it's fast, it's convenient, it's clean. So that's definitely changed things for people. But you're right. Sydney is very much a place where people live on the edge. They live on the edges. You know, the desirable place is all the waterways, and we have a lot of harbour frontage. So, and we live right on the edge, you know, towards the eastern suburbs. And then I feel it's different in Melbourne, where it's actually much more evenly spread because there isn't this harbour that everyone wants to look out onto and be near. And there's no, again, beaches that are these aspirational things to be next to.
Yeah.
Like Melbourne has all these great suburbs like Fitzroy and Carlton and all these other places that are out, you know, they're just sort of a bit more spread out. But because they're more evenly spread, the connection to the city is actually quite quick.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that's the same with Brisbane. Friends who have moved up there, they sort of live in a great house, you know, in a sort of inner suburb area, but within 20 minutes drive of the city, which you just can't get in Sydney.
Yeah, well, I mean, that would be the thing. You can get anywhere around Brisbane about 15 minutes drive without the traffic. But I think the difference I've certainly noticed is that Brisbane just doesn't have the connectivity of bike riding, and I'm a massive bike rider. It's got some. And for me, that was a bit of a choice of actually moving to the Gold Coast versus to Brisbane, because you can still get everywhere, get on flights, get down to Melbourne, get to everywhere within 1 hour. It's very easy to connect to each city. But I must say, as somebody visits Sydney, the ability just to get on the train and that connectivity is part. And that's really obviously why Melbourne's going through its situation from the property side at the moment, because the infrastructure has been the main investment to build that up for the continuous population growth. And I can see that in Queensland, in comparison, there just isn't that connectivity that is being built in the same way. And that's because the density doesn't add up to the per square metre that you need. So there is very interconnected conversations around here. Of, you know, we're talking about overall planning coming down to actually creating communities. But fantastic, really interesting insights. I haven't been able to get that much. Obviously, the other thing is that when we are talking about living, there is obviously about it stacking up. I know, so for some people, that has been one of the parts. You know, Queensland now, for example, houses are more expensive, and I know that personally, than in Melbourne, and what that's looking like. So we're obviously recording it. It's at the end of May in 2026. Sort of where are you seeing things economically from what governments are investing in, but also what developers and what we're seeing is stacking up?
I think it's the unbelievable perfect storm. I've not seen anything like it in 30 years. There's no quick fixes. So labor costs high because we lost a lot of tradespeople during COVID. They went back overseas. They probably look to come back and go, wow, like everything's gone up 20 or 30%. Can I afford to come back to Sydney and work? And where would I live? So I think there's not enough labor to build all the housing that we need. So, and labor costs are not going to come back. No one's going to say, I'll take a paid demotion. Thanks. So that's not going to change. Supply chain has eased. So, well, it had eased until, you know, someone went and bombed Iran. So every time we have these global upsets, it does have an effect on pricing of commodities and materials that we bring into Australia. But that hasn't had the big impact that we saw during COVID. So at this point in time, there is escalation, but no one's screaming about that yet. What has happened is, and we should be seeing it, is that land costs should be coming down per dwelling. And that's where Victoria was always cheaper, because there was availability of developable land. And so no one could hold you to ransom, because if that person asked too much, you'd just go a block down and there was another development site. So it kept things at a reasonable level. In New South Wales, we've potentially upzoned a lot of land for development through all these different policies, the lower mid-rise housing policy, the housing delivery authority. So we should be seeing that per unit, you know, rate for dwellings go down. So, you know, they used to talk about a $30,000 per unit site cost, and then, you know, these went up to 100,000 or 200,000. So borrowing capacity then means that if interest rates go up, people can borrow less. And so if they can't afford to pay more than you can build it for, then the projects don't happen. So it's all these things that are going around. And no one thing will fix it. So we're a very unionized workforce as well on site. So you can imagine that the unions don't want a lot of cheap labor coming into Sydney. So they're quite happy that all the labor costs are high as long as there's work for everybody. So it's interest rates, it's labor, it's access to developable land. All these things are conspiring at the moment to make it very difficult to develop in New South Wales. And I'm sure that that's also having an effect in most of the other states as well.
I must say, obviously, the conversation with Queensland is there's a lot going on because there's been a change of government and they're very, you know, about opening up the doors and they've got to get a lot built. But that the trades and the labour is obviously the biggest constraint that we have. And that's obviously a federal conversation than it is just a state conversation, how we're letting people in. It was interesting. We just recorded prior to this yesterday with the CEO of NAHWIC, and to actually hear how many people we're actually losing out of the industry, particularly at a trade perspective, not just females, but across the industry, is actually quite alarming. So it's not just a retraction, it's also a retention problem. I'll be very interested, and I've stated this previously, to see how this looks over the next 20 years when the parts of AI come in. And we don't know, and that might be a segue into how things might look for the future. But it is obviously a bit of an offshoot question I do have for you there, because we have had this previously. What about with modular? Because obviously modular is one of those things, but it's kind of a bit of a loss to be able to make it stack up in the future. And is that something that's happening you feel is being thought about or might be pushed further to have some solutions?
It's definitely getting more traction. So there's modular and there's modern methods of construction. And they're all slightly different in terms of how you build with those systems. But I would say that's also one of the big problems we have at the moment, is that I'd say over the last three decades is what the Productivity Commission said, is that we actually as a built environment industry, have actually become less productive. And so if we can't increase our productivity, then we're always going to be behind. I see a really big divorce between the front end of what we do. So, you know, we're using VR headsets and we're using AI and we're in a 3D BIM environment doing all this amazing stuff. And yet we still print out our drawings in black and white on pieces of paper, and we give them to builders who then have to visualize our building and build it. And they turn up on site and in a lot of cases pick up a piece of clay, slop some mud on it and lay a brick, just as they were doing 3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So whilst we've moved at the front end of the industry on site, I don't think it's advanced at the same rate. And so modular and MMC is the answer to that. But then, as we just talked about, do the unions want to see job losses? You know, there's that fear potentially that modular and MMC might replace real jobs on site. I don't believe that's the case. I'm hoping that what it means is that those trades move to indoor environments that are weather protected and better quality, and that some of this work on site in dangerous wet weather, you know, all sorts of conditions, is reduced. And so one of the things that has also happened over the last 30 years is that we have a lot more legislation and regulation. And that works against things like modular and MMC, where there isn't a pathway for it. So in New South Wales, if you did a volumetric modular building, they're actually too narrow to comply with the apartment design guide for apartments. And so there's this raft of things where you can only transport modules at certain times of the day. If it's over a certain size, you need a police escort, and there's only certain windows you can do it. So we don't set things up for innovation. You know, because it wasn't something that we were looking at previously. No. But it's definitely,
is that something you see that is done differently from overseas, or how the UK, where your UK studio is?
Yeah, there are. I don't have a lot of experience with it overseas, but you do see in other overseas markets that modular is used a lot more because they may not have the same regulations around it that we do here. And I think a lot of the regulations that we have weren't done to preclude it. It's just that they didn't foresee it. To look at co-living, because co-living doesn't fall under the apartment design guide. Student housing, co-living, hotels, it's perfectly set up for that very repetitive module. When it comes to housing, we're still, really in the infancy of how we might utilize it.
I think we've been quite fortunate to kind of jump right into the kind of thick of our conversation. I think one of the things that we have sort of missed as well, obviously, is that you've been with Turner throughout your time. You know, you said 25 years, and we've talked about how the organisation has grown. I'd like to bring this now back to a bit more of a personal level with yourself and what your sort of development has been through that and your career pathway. So as you said, you've been with one company for 25 years, but that doesn't mean you haven't developed and grown within that time that you've joined. So I'd love you just to kind of step back for me for a step, and then we'll go into the opportunities that we have in the future ahead too. Talk us through a little bit about how your career has developed and how you've also developed as an individual in the built environment as well.
Yeah, well, I think it all starts with saying yes to things. And so my first job was leaving uni. Some friends overseas said, we've started a practice. We're inviting architects from all around the world to work on this project. Would you like to join?
Oh,
and
of course
I went, yes. And so I just packed my bags and hopped overseas to Malaysia and started working in this practice, which had invited architects from Europe and America and Australia and the UK to come together and work on this project. It was fantastic. Unfortunately, the Asian economic crisis killed it about 2 years later. And so when I came back to Australia, I was still very interested in urban renewal rather than individual houses. And, you know, a couple of years into doing that is when Turner started as a practice.
Yeah.
And you just quickly realize you have to do everything. And so at various points in time, I've been the IT guy, the HR person, the secretary. So whatever needs to be done to keep everything moving is what we all did. And so I didn't realize at the time, but that's what eventually set me up for my current role, is actually just having this experience across all the different facets of not just architecture, because I think we were very fortunate to be working from concept all the way through to construction. We were also a very collaborative practice. So we were working with architects from Victoria, from the Netherlands, from Germany, from Asia. So there was lots of learnings. It was always very diverse. And we would just say, why don't we? You know, so it was that idea of just seizing opportunities. So if there was a project and we're like, oh, maybe we'll work with an international architect, we would just call them up and say, hey, we've got this project. Would you like to come and work on this project with us? And inevitably, they also were yes people. They'd say, yes, that sounds like an amazing opportunity.
You know? Right.
And so I think that evolution of working on the business but working in architecture, I think, you know, at my heart, I'm still more interested in architecture and design than the administration side of running a business. But it is also fascinating to, you know, everything that goes into keeping a practice going. And so my role evolved as the practice grew, every time it was a new challenge about, okay, we're getting bigger projects, or we're having to deal with different types of clients, just setting up the practice for growth, and growth and keeping it all afloat through the ups and downs of the architecture and construction cycles in Australia. And I guess work has always been a very comfortable thing for me in terms of I enjoy it. I enjoy working hard at it. I don't really think about the idea of work-life balance. I like to, you know, have a bit of separation between them, but it isn't a chore to come to work. You know, it's exciting and challenging. And so that's why I'm still here. Along the way, there's obviously been people that have, thrown out offers or asked me to go and do something else. But the grass isn't always greener. And as long as you're always continuously learning and being challenged, then money is not the reason why you would go somewhere. I think it's only when you feel like you're standing still, that you're not being challenged to offer more. That's when maybe you need to go and try a new opportunity. But for me, I was always being challenged to do more, to be better. That's partly through the people I work with. I work with, amazing architects and designers and support staff who are never satisfied actually with doing what they've done before and the status quo. They're always challenging each other to do better, to, keep ahead of things. And that keeps you on your toes because even though it's easy to do what you did before, it will be quickly become boring.
A culture of continuous improvement, and it seems that yes, and what
Oh,
do we do?
yes, that's
So how
exactly
does
it.
that, obviously that is part of the ingredients that makes Turner very special, because I just presented on this on the weekend. 90% of businesses are under 20, right? To get over the 100, you're in the very, very small percentages, particularly. And to have that growth even over, 25 years is quite incredible, to be honest, and obviously to do that. So what do you think has made you guys quite special? I think you've described some of it, but how do you sort of communicate that to others?
I was the HR person and I hired lots of good people. But actually, the secret was that we never hired for a job. If we saw a good CV come into the office, we hired them anyway. Because if you get good people, the work will come. It's no good waiting for that opportunity. So that means we have people, we have lots of people here who celebrate 5, 10, 15, and 20 year
Amazing.
anniversaries because they've grown with us as well. And I think one of the most rewarding things is actually seeing somebody and being able to just see their potential at, an early stage and then them being able to deliver on that and grow. And some people leave and do even more amazing things, which is fantastic. But you get a lot of satisfaction out of people who, really kind of realize their full potential. So there's definitely that from a people point of view. And then I think from a just a general growth point of view, it was to not be afraid to say yes, even though you're really busy, to never forget that you need a pipeline of work. And it's easy to go, oh, I'm really busy. I better not take that on. But then after you've been doing it for a while, you realize that when clients tell you it's starting tomorrow, that could be a year away, it could be 6 months away. It's a very complex business. And even though they would love to start tomorrow, they also haven't got everything sorted either. And so, same thing with ridiculous programs. They inevitably evolve. Everything evolves. And we always take this approach that whatever you're doing, don't ever think it's the last time you're going to look at it and that it's fixed in stone. It's going to change. So be open to the change, see it as an opportunity. I think there's always that tendency to, as an artist, to finish that artwork and go, okay, it's done, it's perfect. And I think that's actually false. I think, when you kind of are more open to it, you let it go a little bit. And then when someone challenges it or something changes it, you should actually go back and look at it and go, actually, this could be better. There's places to change this. And I find that even through our current culture of design review panels and all that sort of design excellence that we have, it sometimes hurts to get the feedback that actually when you go through it and they've challenged you and you actually have, I guess, challenged yourself to do something better. You actually acknowledge that it's a better outcome. So I think that constant challenge is good for people, you know?
Oh, look, I mean, I'm an HR person, right? So you're sort of just like ticking off everything you try and say to people. Growth mindset, say yes, continuous improvement, having a psychologically safe environment where you feel like your people can come in and be open and honest, because it's about the best outcome. It's not about hurting people's feelings, and if it's done in the right way, it will never be taken in that way. But it sounds like, if your representation as the MD of the company, it's that ethos and approach. That's not, it's not surprising to hear. Now it makes a lot of sense when you see a brand sort of grow and you see that it's the underlying ethos and the values of what we are that come through. And there's other firms who are celebrating 100 years, and what are those parts that make somebody special and actually gets to that element. It sounds like you've got a lot of those ingredients that we would see that would align to success.
Yeah, I would say it is something though that you, not everyone has it, and I think most of us have to learn it, including myself, which is when you become more senior, you can either force things through by sheer will, or you learn to listen to other voices and be a bit more adaptive and agile and be willing to admit you're wrong or that you should change tack. And sometimes it's not even being wrong. It's actually hearing those voices and going, you know what, it makes sense to just change tack slightly. And that's just being a little bit agile. But I think the diversity of voices, so that you're not just hearing yourself, and we were the same. So we have a bunch of senior people who, when you do the, I think it's the Herman Miller brain sort of thing, we all pretty much overlap. And that's actually our blind spot. That's our weakness, in that we're so similar that we don't actually have a diversity of voices at the table. And so we've actually actively made sure that there are more different sort of voices now.
Cognitive diversity within what you're bringing to the table. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other stream. We've had some other podcasts about what is really diversity and making sure it is. But it's also then, it's no point having a diversity of thought and parts if you don't have the culture and the values to enable for that difference to be heard and to do that. So it sounds absolutely incredible. Now, I suppose, obviously, you know, we're in an age where AI is at the forefront. So tell us a little bit about where you guys are at. And I know you'd mentioned a lot around, yours has also been about the governance approach that you take to that. And I think that's a really important conversation to have as well.
Yes. Yeah, so one of our directors actually gave a presentation recently to the Institute of Architects, one of the practice forums they have, about how we engage with it. And so we have this framework at the moment, or an approach to it, which says you can either use it to replace what you're doing, you can use it to enhance what you're doing, or you can exclude it and pretend it doesn't exist. So in those three streams, we're in the one of enhancing what we do. So we don't see it as replacing what we do. It's not there yet, and it may never be there yet. I think it's a tool that we all need to harness. But you can't blindly trust it, just as you wouldn't blindly trust a junior person within your office. And so that's how we sort of regard it, as a junior member of the team that's learning, that can get things wrong, and that you need to give it good information, you need to give it really good instruction, and you need to then check the outputs. So it is definitely useful across all aspects of practice. Mm. I think it's more advanced in some parts than others. But it comes with a danger, and that is that the young people that use it, they don't potentially have the experience to be able to critically review it and engage with it. And so as senior members of the practice, we can look at things quite quickly and go, that's not right, and that doesn't sound right, and, you know, that needs to change. And so where do people get that experience and knowledge? I think that's why it can never replace those. You still have to go through those learnings and the hard bits in order to be able to use it properly.
Well, I think that opens up a really interesting question too, because a lot of the tasks that may replace are tasks that junior people may be doing. So as a practice, how do you continue to train people or make sure that that's in there, that it doesn't just become a, yep, that's been done, but actually understanding some of the fundamental blocks of learning those things as you go through?
Well, I think it's, you teach people how to be strategic thinkers, and that's something that I probably took away from uni in a particular lecturer, is always to be thinking first. And that's, so if you're doing drawing work, it's really understanding the principles and the strategy behind what you're doing, so that you can then give the repetitive parts of that off to AI. But you need to be the person who understands it at that very strategic level. So when AI does whatever it does and comes back, you can then overlook that and be able to understand whether or not it's carried out that task successfully or not. Mm-hmm. So that still needs to happen, and that's still going to be a passing down of experience and the ways that we work, so that you can use this tool. So yeah. it's always the training will still have to be there.
Oh, look, I mean, and we've had this conversation, the architect, and you know, we've done for engineers and MPMs, that the actual part that we actually all really want to do will remain, because the project is not built just by a machine, it's built by people, and it's built by those people come together. And as you said, the strategic understanding of where we're going. I think it's a great explanation you've given today around it. I see it in the same way. It is a tool, but at the same time, you need to have somebody who's strategically understanding where we're going, the dynamics of what's being achieved, which can be inputted, but at the same time, you know, it's understanding where the building's going to go. I think in the next 5 years, it'll be very interesting to see how it now starts to come into the documentation. Obviously, most people are starting to use it in the front end. I think there's, you know, I spoke to somebody the other day and they said, look, we're using it for one bit here. If you're trying to, it's not at that point yet, we can do it for everything. But it certainly, as another director said, you know, doing door schedules, great. I mean, who loves doing door schedules? Nobody.
Yeah, that's right. Who likes checking, you know, consultant drawing overlays and clashes with structure? It's super important, but if something else can do it, at least the repetitiveness of it. So we're not doing houses, we're doing 1,200 apartments in a 40-story building. There's a lot of repetition that hopefully you can teach something to do, as long as you can then overlook it and go, yep, that looks right. Or, yeah, you still need to do all the checking. We're not there yet. Yeah,
absolutely. And so, look, what are some of the skills that you see that people need to be making sure they're continuing to develop in their career?
Definitely the critical thinking. So I just can't emphasize enough that you always need to be asking questions about and learning, always trying to learn more. So, you know, architects are the lead consultant. We're supposed to know a little bit about everything, but things are getting more complex. So in order for you to be a well-rounded architect and understand how buildings come together and you know, what shapes design, you need to keep across, you know, all the different kind of disciplines and what's happening in the industry. But it's that critical thinking of then being able to, you know, get information back in, because you become that holder and coordinator of information, and then being able to challenge it and go, well, is there a different solution to that, because I'm not getting a good outcome? Or, you know, could we take a different approach to something where, you know, three or four things might come together to provide a better outcome? So not being accepting always of what people are telling you. If you've got enough information to inform yourself about the holistic project, then I think you work better as a team, because you challenge each other. I think, again, it's that idea of you challenge each other to not just look after one's own interests, you know, as a consultant, to be thinking about actually you work broadly more as a team, and what you do could affect somebody else, but in a good way. And that is not how, again, our industry and the way that we have been taught has been set up, all the way from builders through to, you know, I guess, documenting and construction. I think we've tended to be more siloed and be thinking, I just want to get my job done, and then, you know, it's someone else's problem, as opposed to taking a much more team-based approach to this.
Absolutely. And, you know, I did a presentation on this the other day, and people want to work with people. Right. So if you're not helpful, or if you're taking this in, or even proactive communication and being able to say to somebody, I can't get this done by this time, we'll get this done, the flow on effects. At the end of the day, projects are a team. Right. It's no one person. I'm sure some of the projects that have been brilliant, you've had great teams on internally and externally in some of the projects. Most people remember the people that they spent on the projects. Obviously, you guys get a tangible outcome as well, but that's a really fundamental element that I think is about understanding, how do we make sure that we help each other? We're not hindering. We're not here to combat. We're actually here to make sure that we get a great outcome, and that means us all figuring out how we work together to achieve that too. Excellent. Thank you so much, Carl, for all of your time. Now, we always sort of end on, is there a podcast or somebody you find of influence, or a book or something that you would like to share that you've found quite insightful or valuable?
Oh, well, I'm listening to a few different podcasts at the moment. They're non-architectural. There's one on AI, which doesn't kind of come to mind at the moment. The rest is politics, you know, the US as well as the UK version. I mean, what's happening in the world at the moment, you know, does impact our lives in Australia. And yeah, just fascinating to see what's happening overseas. It feels like Australia is a very safe place in that sense,
Oh,
eventually.
we're sometimes us being so far from everywhere is actually a good thing, but we are so geopolitically in a very interesting area. So we do actually get a lot of the impacts, and sometimes that further because things have to be shipped from a supply point of view does also have quite an effect on us. Brilliant. Thank you so much for all of your time, and we've absolutely loved it.
Yeah, thanks, Seton. Been a pleasure.